Before we start this episode of CFD's Podcast for Good, let's give a little shout out to our presenting sponsor, WSECU. WSECU has been a part of the community since 1957 and has been supporting the CFD in a big way since 2011. Thanks to them, we were able to bring you spectacular events and promotions like the Masquerade Ball, Golf for Veterans Tournament, and our incredible First Week to Give, which has been responsible for raising tens of thousands of dollars in donations to charities throughout our community. For more on how WSECU serves charities throughout our community, visit www.wsecu.org/community. And of course, visit our website to find out more about our incredible partnership with WSECU. And now, here's the show.
Me too.
get loose, get the vocal cords.
Ooh,
good.
A cough drop. I wonder if that's a problem.
No, I don't think so. Just so long as you don't do that thing
that
where you're
rattling,
like, rattling it around. And all right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of the Combined Fund Drives Podcast for Good. This is becoming an annual affair. As you know, we are housed at the Office of the Secretary of State. My name is Philip Kerrigan. I'm the program manager of the CFD. Our particular entity is administered by the Secretary of State in the Community Programs Division, which is home to a bunch of different really neat little programs, including the one we're talking to today, Legacy Washington. Thank you guys for coming on the podcast.
Thank you, Phil.
So before we begin, let's introduce ourselves, just in case people don't remember the rousing conversation we had last year about 1968.
How could they forget that?
Exactly. Let's start left to right. Go ahead, sir. What's your name and what do you do?
Bob Young, historian for Legacy Washington.
And you?
Lori Larson. I'm senior researcher.
Senior researcher. And you?
I'm John Hughes. I'm the chief historian.
Excellent. And thank you guys for coming to the podcast. We're going to talk about this year's theme that you have created. So first of all, before we get into any of that, talk a little bit about Legacy Washington. Who wants to take the question that actually talks about Legacy Washington? Oh, Lori, they're looking at you. And why it is we're back talking about another theme like you do this year over year. So can you talk a little bit about what it is that Legacy does?
So Legacy Washington, it really focuses on the stories of Washington State, the people, how they get to where they are, what makes them tick. We use primary sources from the library, archives all over the state, University of Washington. We also use newspapers as background research to really make sure that these stories aren't just verbatim, but the facts are accurate. Mm-hmm. Memories can be different than
right.
than the reality of things sometimes.
Yeah.
But so then each year we come up with a different theme. Sometimes it's related to dates, mm-hmm, which mm-hmm. this one is. So 2020 is the 100th anniversary of women's suffrage, the right to vote, mm-hmm. for most women in the United States.
Yeah.
And we did this 10 years ago when Washington State celebrated their centennial.
Yeah.
And focused on women first.
Okay.
So first governor, Secretary of State, all of those posts, the statewide elected officials. This year, we wanted to do something different. And because Washington is ahead of the curve when it comes to women's right to vote,
nicely
we were number
done.
Five.
Branding, right on brand.
Yes. We really carried this throughout our subjects and making sure that they weren't just the first. Mm-hmm. They were really pushing the envelope and not just doing amazing things in Washington, but outside mm-hmm. of Washington and even internationally.
Yeah. So you buried the lead a little bit. The name of this year's exhibit and book that goes along with it is Ahead of the Curve.
Yeah.
And so it centers mostly around basically strong women during that time period of both the right to vote and then My understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong, we might edit this out because I could get this dead wrong, is you also then, you pair them with folks from who are still alive today or who are from a more modern time, or is that not accurate?
It's pretty much the factual there.
Excellent.
Phil.
Thank you very much, Chief Historian John Hughes. Can you talk a little bit about, we'll start here with you. Can you talk a little bit about the theme overall and why you decided to go with this theme besides just the time period?
Sure. Well, you could say when Washington women, you could say actually pretty much invented the curve, because in 1910, 10 years before the passage of the 19th Amendment, national suffrage, they won the right to vote. And they won it in all 39 counties by a vote of more than 64%. And it, Shanna Stevenson, Olympia historian who wrote a wonderful book called Women's Votes, Women's Voices, about the suffrage movement, said that the vote in Washington in 1910 really reinvigorated the national drive. It had been pretty much dormant.
Okay.
So these Washington women were really remarkable pace setters nationally.
Yeah.
They had alliances with the national suffrage figures, mostly from back east, but women like Josephine Corliss Preston from Walla Walla, who was elected the first ever female statewide elected official in 1912, was the absolute beneficiary of women getting the vote in Washington State. And she formed an alliance with national suffrage leaders 9 years down the road in 1919, 1920, to make certain that Washington ratified the 19th Amendment. And we were the next to last state, pass the torch to Tennessee. And there's a wonderful story about Tennessee, that the Tennessee legislature was deeply conflicted over the 19th Amendment, and we're just teetering. It was teetering what pass or fail. And a young legislator was lobbied by his mother to change his vote.
And
Bob and I and Lori argued that mother really deserves a statue of her own, because she enacted paved the way for the 19th Amendment.
Now, it wasn't easy in Washington State by any stretch of the imagination to be one of the first states to give women the right to vote, right? I mean, the Supreme Court overturned it a few times, did it not?
Well, back in 1883,
women
first got the right to vote in Washington.
Is that the first ever?
No.
Oh, okay.
Wyoming preceded them by a number of years.
Wyoming.
They were
shout out to Wyoming.
That time. Yeah.
But the movement really did spring from the western states for different reasons. Some people thought it was because giving women voting rights would entice. There was an imbalance, but there were not enough women for the men, and so that would entice women to come. There was also a thought that, as I've understood it, that in these pioneering families, women worked so hard, were such equals that it just was obvious that they deserved this this right.
Yeah, and so then they fought it all the way from 1883 all the way until 1910.
In 88 or 89, the Supreme Court of the territory invalidated those rights of women to serve on a jury and vote.
Wow.
It was pretty breathtaking what the court did. I mean, it was probably one of the most definitive examples of male chauvinism in the history of Washington. And there's a document that we have in the state archives in the Office of the Secretary of State that shows that in the court record that they put a little carrot mark and wrote in male to indicate that female voters were being disenfranchised.
That's amazing. That's unbelievable.
It really is.
Yeah, they added before citizens.
Male citizens.
Wow. So how many folks do you highlight in this particular exhibit, Lori? Do you know?
I think we don't have enough fingers. I think it's 21.
21?
Bob's right. Okay. Right. Yeah.
Not all of them have full stories.
Okay. Okay.
Some are exhibit panels.
So let's talk about a little bit about some of the sort of the way these sort of usually come out, how Legacy Washington really does this year over year. So you typically highlight About, I would say, I mean, I think I've noticed like 10 to 12 folks, really, typically.
Yeah, that's
accurate. And typically you're telling the story of a particular theme, like a few years ago it was statehood, and then last year was 1968, through the lens of these individuals and their experiences. And then you also have these sort of cool things. I remember the state exhibit had this like really neat panel where it talked about how there were three different cities who were vying to be the capital of Washington State, and how they were all like warring against each other through the paper. Do you have any of that this year, or are you really focusing on the individuals and telling the story of this movement just through the individuals, or do you have panels that will do more of that sort of like also hear some other things that happened during that time?
Right next to the intro panel is a panel that focuses on the fact that not all women received the right to vote in 1910 Washington or 1920.
Oh, wow.
Nationally, when you think of minorities. And
so they were still even excluded even when that, even when that passed.
It varies by minority group, the reasoning why.
Mm-hmm.
But Bob went through and thoroughly made sure of the different dates that different groups of women received access to voting.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think the latest would be,
I want to say 52,
oh,
was
wow.
it? 1952, when finally the, women who were American citizens, mm-hmm. if they married immigrants, would lose that citizenship
status. No way.
Status. Yeah.
Absolutely.
They were still kind of tethered to the status of their husbands. And so for different reasons, some of them geopolitical, having to do with alliances,
yeah.
some of them having to do with, racism,
mm-hmm.
It wasn't until 1952 that women who married
immigrants,
Korean immigrants,
yes, Korean.
were enfranchised.
Wow.
And similarly, those Korean immigrants could not become naturalized citizens until that time.
Wow. Yeah. That's unbelievable. That's like 7 years ago.
It's breathtaking, isn't it?
Yeah, that's unbelievable.
By the same token, Native Americans, American Indians, regardless of gender, mm-hmm. could not vote until 1922.
Yeah.
Twenty-four. And there.
Boy, they really slow played all of that. Didn't
yeah.
they were like, 1919, we gotcha. Oh, also, we got about six or seven other groups we haven't quite.
Right.
Yeah, it takes another 30 years to get that all worked out. Unbelievable.
Yeah, so I really always kind of try to throw in that most women.
Yeah.
You know, to be more accurate.
Right, right.
Yeah.
So we'll start with Bob on this question, and then we're going to go just straight down the line, because I always love to hear this from you guys. Who was the most interesting subject that you researched or interviewed during this process?
Man. I mean, that changes from day to day. It really does.
Yeah.
It really does. I don't know. I there's so many. Elsie Parrish, I think, remains probably my favorite story.
Okay.
Elsie Parrish was a Wenatchee chambermaid during the Depression, and she worked at what was then the Splendid Cascadian Hotel. She
Splendid
knew that
Cascadian.
Washington was ahead of the curve because mm-hmm. it was one of the first states to have a minimum wage.
Oh, wow.
And the first wave of minimum wages were for women and children.
Wow.
And so we were a leader in that regard. But the United States Supreme Court, in multiple cases, had invalidated the state regulations of work conditions, including pay. But Elsie was a grandma with gumption, as we say, and even though she was only in her late 30s, she became a mother at 15. She lived a very kind of hard life on the prairies, first in Kansas and then in Montana before coming to Washington. Anyway, so she took her fight to get paid Washington's minimum wage all the way to the United States Supreme Court, where the court had a change of heart and mind, it seemed.
Yeah.
And by a 5-4 majority, basically one justice changed his view.
Yeah.
And they then validated Washington's minimum wage.
Wow.
And that, in effect, cleared a legal path for FDR's New Deal.
Yeah.
That court had knocked down a dozen
That's
of
cool.
the New Deal proposals. And that same day as Elsie's case in 1937, March 29, 1937, they approved another pro-labor measure. And then in a couple of weeks, They approved the Wagner Act, which was called America's American Labor Magna Carta, mm-hmm. and from there Social Security and the gates just opened.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's
and awesome. The best part, or not the best part, one of the great parts about Elsie's story, mm-hmm. is that she was unknown largely to history.
Yeah.
The history really focused on this justice who changed his mind and
yeah.
why,
right.
and not the chambermaid. And so her descendants didn't even know of her landmark lawsuit, including her great-grandniece, the first woman of governor of Oregon, Barbara Roberts, did not know.
Wow, really?
Yeah.
Really? That's crazy.
Yeah.
That's a good one. How about you, Lori? What was one of the most, who was one of the most interesting subjects you either had a chance to sit down with or researched?
Oh. Philip, I can't.
I prepped you for like a
it's
week
like
on this.
Your favorite child.
Lori, I'm going to just jump and say Lori has become friends with probably the greatest soccer player of all time. Woman soccer player of all time, excuse me.
Who's that?
So what's your Michelle opinion on that? Akers.
Okay.
Bob was the one who wrote the exhibit panel, but I've been in touch with her and she's been super gracious.
Yeah.
When you reach out to these. Here we are, this little state program. Yeah. When you reach out to these big time people,
yeah.
you don't necessarily know who the right person is to connect with or
right.
how to get in touch and let them know, you know, that their face is going to be on the wall of the Washington State Capitol.
Mm-hmm.
But she
for a year.
Big.
And it's super
big
face. It's
yeah.
real huge. Yeah.
Right. But Michelle literally was titled the Women Player of the Century.
Wow.
By the International.
Really? FIFA Women Player of the Century.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
Do you want to talk about, so in 1990?
About Michelle?
Yeah.
Oh, well, just, I mean, she was a graduate of Shorecrest High School
okay.
in Shoreline, which she led to a state title. And then she went on to the first versions of the U.S. National Women's Team.
Awesome.
And led them to the first World Cup victory in 1991. Was the leading scorer, scored both goals, the both U.S. goals in the decisive
yeah.
game, was the leading scorer in the tournament.
Yeah.
Then she went on to lead the U.S. to a gold medal in 96 yeah. in Sydney, even though she was suffering at that time from chronic fatigue syndrome.
Oh, well.
And then in 99, she was,
yeah.
she
yeah.
was you know, an important and influential figure in the 1999 World Cup won by that charismatic team known
yes.
as the 99ers, who
yeah.
really elevated women's sports. And a great story of how she'd got knocked out by her own goalie, Brianna Scurry, and was in the locker room recovering from that and dehydration. She had IVs in both her arms when the U.S. won on Brandi Chastain's
yeah.
penalty kick.
Yeah.
And she ripped the IV lines out of her arms to go out on the field and celebrate.
That's awesome.
That's passion.
That's
yeah.
awesome.
So I'm sorry to jump
in. That's awesome.
No. Yeah.
So is that your favorite one? And what's she do now?
She has a horse rescue
get out of here.
Organization farm in Georgia.
Yep.
Wow,
yeah.
that's cool.
Yeah.
That's cool. That's awesome. So, John?
Well, I really love Lori's line about picking which one. It's like choosing
yeah.
your favorite child.
I see you,
I see you
sweating over
and
here.
I love the notion that we get to tell stories that have been forgotten.
Right.
And there's a woman, a lady surgeon from Seattle in 1918 named Mabel Seagrave.
Mm-hmm.
And of all the women, the women who are no longer with us, who are trailblazers, I think Mabel's the one I wish I could conjure up right now because
yeah.
she was just absolutely remarkable. In 1918, she was a graduate of Wellesley College, an elite women's college.
Mm-hmm.
She came back to Seattle, taught for a while, and was admitted to the Johns Hopkins Medical School. One of three or four women at that
yeah.
time. And in 1918, after she had become a surgeon in Seattle, she volunteered to go to the front lines in France as a surgeon.
Wow.
And what she saw there was just extraordinary, the carnage.
Mm-hmm.
And afterwards, she volunteered to stay on when the so-called Spanish flu was just killing
right.
millions.
Right.
It was actually, there was a phrase invented at that time called more deadly than war
mm-hmm.
because of the flu. Was killing a lot more men and a few
right.
women who died in World War I. So the French gave her their Medal of Honor, their Silver Medal of Honor. And it's really interesting. Her role as a suffragist was really italicized by the fact that Carrie Chapman Catt, an amazing suffrage figure, was president of the National American Woman Suffrage Association. And when Mabel got back from overseas, they gave her the keys to the city and a Merit of Honor Award.
Wow.
And it said that saying that she had demonstrated that strength, courage, and patriotism were not just male attributes. But
awesome.
The best thing about Mabel that we found out was that she really had this amazingly playful side.
Mm-hmm.
She was kind of a heavy set lady. She loved theatricals. All through high school and college, she'd played in theatricals. And when she joined the Women's University Club of Seattle, its minutes and club lore is replete with these stories of Mabel portraying Teddy Roosevelt and Benito Mussolini. And she's dressed up like Roosevelt, the Rough Rider, with a pince-nez, spectacles on her nose. And she just must have been an absolute hoot.
Yeah.
So she was, by the way, in 1928, one of two women in the United States of America admitted to the American College of Surgeons, which was really prestigious.
That's cool.
So I wish we could conjure up Mabel.
She sounds like she'd be a good time, that's for sure.
She really was.
She'd have fun.
And there was Bob suggested to me that we look into this woman, and he actually set out to do her, and his plate got too full. So I ended up getting to do a profile of a really remarkable self-effacing woman named Linnea Laird.
Mm-hmm.
And Linnea Laird, all she did in her career of 38 years with the Washington State Department of Highways was to oversee construction of the new Tacoma Narrows Bridge, the department's first ever female chief engineer.
Wow.
Oversaw the Alaska Way Viaduct replacement, the Highway 99 tunnel.
What?
And when she retired, Mayor Durkin called her back into combat in 2018 when the Seattle Department of Transportation needed a new leader.
Wow.
And so when we summoned in Linnea, and the first thing she said to Bob and then later to me was, "Why would you do me? I don't even have a college degree."
Oh, wow.
She had fallen in love with the University of Montana, if memory serves. Her husband was a graduate engineer.
Yeah.
She followed him off to Bremerton, started her career undegreed, and then painstakingly, while being a mom to two kids, passed all these tests to become a certified engineer.
Yeah.
And I really like that story. I think that's
really cool.
That her gumption and her self-effacing nature and what she achieved is... I think it's really symbolic of a lot of these women.
Oh, yeah. I think that story could be, you could replace her name with the name of thousands of,
absolutely.
Of women who enter the workplace and then have kids and then go back to get their college degree and to do all of that sacrifice.
Well, I think it really resonates with me because my mom, a single mom, had a degree from Berkeley, California, UC Berkeley, in her whole career with the telephone company in the 1950s and 1960s, she was never really promoted to being a manager.
Right.
She was always a supervisor because she was a woman.
Mm-hmm.
So my mom, whom you would have liked, always would grouse at home at night that they trotted in some new 30-year-old MBA kid to run the office, and she'd have to wipe his nose and tell him how the trains run on time.
Yeah, that's funny. So is there something, you kind of already hit on a few of these things, but was there something overall that any of you guys learned that through this process that might have been different than what you originally thought going in, like a preconceived notion about the history of the suffrage movement or you know, who did what? Was there something that you thought originally, oh, well, this is the narrative I've seen? And then you began to dig deeper and you noticed, oh, no, that's not how that went.
I did not realize how many righteous, good-hearted men joined the suffrage movement. In fact, in the East, some of them actually marched side by side with the suffragists under banners calling themselves the suffragettes.
Oh.
And I looked really hard to try to find whether there was a formal movement under that banner in Washington State. There wasn't. But the fact that 64% of the electorate in all 39 counties in 1910, ratified suffrage tells you that the women weren't alone.
That's right. Yeah, that's cool.
Maybe you'll feel a little bit better as a male human being. So,
yeah. Bob, anything from you that you thought you knew that in your research turned things around? I mean, L.C. Parrish by herself seems like that. But.
Yeah, I mean, the project is just full of those surprises. And, you know, and I think one of our subjects is influential historian Stephanie Kuntz, who's writing about the evolution of marriage and what it really has been and what it's not been and some of the myths we've attributed to it. Her writing about marriage and her research influenced the United States Supreme Court in their 5-4. Here we are back to a 5-4. You see how history is tenuous enough to be shaped by one person sometimes. Anyway, and I'm not giving all that to Stephanie, but her writing on marriage and its evolution from an unequal property contract, which it had been for thousands of years. And as Stephanie would say, you know, the purpose of marriage for most of its history was to build a labor supply and get good in-laws, you know. but anyway, her writing about that evolution from an unequal property contract to a gender-neutral bond of love ended up influencing Anthony Kennedy in the opinion he wrote for the court. He cited her work twice on marriage. Yeah, as I say, just after citing Confucius and Cicero.
Yeah.
So she's in pretty good company.
Pretty good company.
Yeah.
So that's an example. And, you know, and Stephanie is just full of those kinds of, she is a myth buster in a sense, a debunker she became through her study of American history and families. Yeah. And so, for instance, her probably best known book, The Way We Never Were, takes a look at America's fascination or its nostalgia for the good old 1950s. And Stephanie's research showed that they weren't quite that. The rates of child abuse and poverty and marital discord and other measures were much higher then than they've been in these subsequent decades.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
See, that is something new.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
So... you obviously hit a lot on the deep history dating all the way back to pre 20th century, and then you also have some subjects who are modern day heroines, if you will. Can you talk a little bit about some of the instances of progress that you have seen over the years? So, what are some examples of when you started looking into something? Then you saw a new inflection point, say even 100 years later. What are some good examples of areas where progress was made and we should be really proud that we saw that progress?
The Washington State Supreme Court.
Really? Yeah. So expand on that, sir.
Well, it's pretty amazing. When I started with the Legacy Project in 2008, one of the first profiles we did was with Federal Judge Carolyn Dimmock, who was the first woman appointed to the Washington State Supreme Court.
Okay.
In Carolyn's story, Lori and I were just struck when we started to do the research about how chauvinistic and sexist was all the newspaper clippings around Carolyn Dimmock's rise. Mm-hmm. When she passed the law exam, the Seattle Post-Intelligencer headlined her as "Pretty Blonde Water Skier Passes
really?
The bar." And then when she became a municipal judge, I mean, it was just, the writing was just like ooh la la sexism. Like you'd expect to, when you walk into a courtroom, you would expect a judge to be a man, male, distinguished, pipe smoking, whatever. And here's Carolyn Dimmock, what a revelation she is. And she's wearing heels. And, and so if you fast forward to 2002, Mary Fairhurst, a Gonzaga University graduate who was a deputy attorney general, decided to run for the Washington Supreme Court.
Yeah.
And her narrow victory over a very assertive man created the first female majority in the history of the Washington Supreme Court. And now, across the way from the flag circle from where we sit right now, Mary Fairhurst at 62 is the Chief Justice of the Washington Supreme Court, which has a female majority, one of the few in America, and it's really remarkable. In interviewing these judges, these female justices, it was pretty remarkable. Barbara Madsen, Justice Madsen, who had been Chief Justice, Lori and I and Bob, not to mention my wife, practically came out of their chairs cheering when they read Justice Madsen's comments about what it was like to be a member of the court with a male majority and how different it was. And Justice Madsen really, in a gentlewomanly way, pulled no punches about the what the difference, what it's like today to be listened to. So Mary Fairhurst, the continuum of being ahead of the curve goes forward to 2002 in this landmark event where women for the first time become a majority. And I think they were the, if I recall correctly, they were the second court in America to have a female majority.
Wow, that's cool. That's amazing. That's exactly right. Well, how about you? What have you noticed in looking at these things, sort of like progression that we should basically be proud of as a state?
Bob introduced me to the word shiro, and I just love that word. And I think that we have some really phenomenal shiros in this state. And just, I'm going to think outside of our state and the nation and go internationally here. Melinda Gates is featured on our wall.
Oh, cool.
She needs no introduction.
Yeah. I think people have heard of her.
She has a new book out, and she's really focused on women, women's rights, and how communities can rise when you give women those equal rights.
Yeah.
And Mary Claire King is another one. I would say she is probably one of my favorite ones. She is a geneticist from the University of Washington. We would all be aware of her biggest, one of her biggest accomplishments. This woman has many, which is the discovery of the breast cancer gene.
Oh, wow.
Which has really been a big help to women in preventative care when this is something just in their genetic makeup. So that has huge international repercussions. She's also been a social justice advocate and someone who has worked with, like, for example, Argentina. Bob did this story, so I'm looking at him.
She, well, in addition to discovering the gene after a 17-year quest, the gene linked to inherited breast cancer, she had also pioneered DNA forensics, the likes of which you see now on every television show. So she was asked to go to Argentina and help the so-called abuelas, the grandmothers. Argentina had this internal conflict known as the Dirty War. A military took over the government, and they began, as the Argentines say, disappearing people who were considered dissidents of any kind. And with them often went their children. And some of the dissidents who were rounded up, imprisoned and later killed, were also pregnant. So anyway, there were these children that were lost. Their parents were lost, but the grandmothers began this vigil in front of the presidential palace, trying to find their grandchildren. Eventually, Mary Claire King helped them and devised these tests that could make the confirmation without the parent between the grandparent and the grandchild. So amazing.
Yeah. That's cool.
And Jen, she's, you know, we don't have time to cover all of her accomplishments. You know, she's working with inherited deafness in Israeli and Palestinian children. She's her PhD thesis about how the genetic makeup of chimpanzees and humans are 99% similar. That was her PhD thesis. It landed on the cover of Science Magazine. On and on. Helen Hunt played her in a motion picture. Called That's Decoding Annie Parker. There's a lot there. I mean, it's an amazing cast of women. And, you know, John mentioned Linnea, you know, who ends up you know, it's just something fascinating about where we start, and she ends up overseeing these mega projects,
yeah.
you know, this thoroughly modern thing, mega yeah. monster transportation project.
Right.
But anyway, we've got, you know, bases covered from extraordinary women, from mountaineering to medicine,
yeah.
as I like to say, soccer to science, engineering to education. It is quite a cast of yeah. characters.
Native Americans.
Yeah, yeah. with yeah. this, just this... can do. That's the thread I find running through
okay.
them, is these women just facing these obstacles and just saying,
I'm going to move
I'm
forward.
I'm going. So. Yes, we can. You know,
yeah.
Mary Claire King, uh-huh. you know, women scientists and women geneticists were not that common
right.
back then. And by the way, Mary Claire, you know, says, I am a child of affirmative action. I think her skill set would have been a success anyway,
right?
But it was a really important opening for her. So people like that, just, you know, her saying, I'm determined to find this gene. I believe it exists. I believe there's an inherited form of cancer.
Yeah.
When all the science said that it was a virus that was yeah. environmentally influenced, and on with Trish Malines Ziko, who rose, an African American woman. How rare is that in mm-hmm. technology? Rose from programming to prominence, and became a millionaire at Microsoft at 39, and then just walked away
yeah.
in order. From all that money, that was when they're still giving stock options,
yeah.
In order to teach computer skills to minority women.
Wow.
Didn't have a model, didn't have a template, just said, I know this is needed.
Yeah.
And believe me, there were obstacles galore. But as her wife says, Trish is about action.
Yeah.
So off she went. And it's kind of one story after another. Elsie, the chambermaid, who would not give up,
yeah.
and on with these folks.
One incredible woman I discovered is Melissa Arnott Reed,
uh-huh.
Another international figure. She, in her early 20s, became a mountain guide at Rainier,
yeah.
Has climbed Mount Rainier over 100 times.
Okay.
She has lots of skill sets,
wow.
medical aid and all of that,
uh-huh.
but she is the first woman to climb Mount Everest.
Huh.
To ascend and descend without the use of supplemental oxygen, an
oh
American woman. Yeah.
What?
So she's climbed the Mount Everest a total of 6 times.
Yep. Wow.
I believe 3 out of 6 times was trying to do it without oxygen,
yeah.
and she finally made it the last time.
Bob and I were trying to get up the 42 steps of the Capitol. Oh, yeah,
I was
supplemental oxygen.
Oh, for real.
Philip, you've done that with the...
Yeah, no, I
Mount Rainier without the oxygen.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I remember we were filming this thing at the Wild Horses Monument for one of our silly videos, and I was with Jerrica, who is our marketing person. We were walking up, and she's in such better shape than me. So she was up and doing normal and breathing fine. And I found myself taking about 6 timeouts. Like, look at the view. It's so beautiful. It's so nice.
Right?
So yeah. Mount Rainier, Everest without oxygen, not happening.
Yeah.
That's unbelievable.
We'll
right.
give you Michelle's email.
Yeah, yeah. She can train you.
Yeah. And Melissa's pretty cool. I mean, her Sherpa guide died in an avalanche,
wow.
and she started a philanthropy.
Wow.
Right. She co-founded the Juniper Fund to help support
okay.
those families
yeah.
when so many Western climbers, you know,
yeah.
Depend on those
Sherpas.
Nepalese guides. Mm-hmm. This is a fund to help support the families that
yeah.
lose their
yeah.
member on the mountain.
So, Lori, a question for you, and I guess for the whole group, but we'll start with you. How do you, because you have 21 subjects and you've run through about 10 of them right now, mm-hmm. and they're all incredibly interesting, how do you decide who you're going to target and how you're going to do that?
That is a creative process.
Yeah. Yeah.
Bob's still trying to understand how we do that. it really is. You have to do the research to begin with,
mm-hmm.
to even recognize if they fit to the
what
guidelines
to
that
yeah.
we put in place.
Yeah. Right.
So with this one, we really wanted them to not just be pushing the envelope in Washington, but I feel like more so touching nationally and internationally.
Yeah.
And
because we're ahead of the curve, Washington State is.
Right.
nationally and internationally.
Yeah.
Anyways.
So. Yeah. Well, it definitely sounds like it. There's all these firsts that come out.
We want these stories to be factual. Uh-huh. And you find along the way that we used to say in the newspaper business that the best way to ruin a really good story is to check it out. So you need to really do your homework to make certain that you're on the right track. Mm-hmm. But she put it really well. We just kick stuff around.
Yeah.
And it's amazing sometimes.
How many times do you come to a dead end? Where you are picking a subject, you think it's really interesting, you're like, oh man, we're going to be able to really flesh out this person's profile. And you get to a certain point, you're like, oh man, I just don't know that there's enough there, or we can't get an interview, or we can't find it. How many times has that happened to you?
Yeah, in the course of doing the project, it happens for different reasons, yeah. I mean, I at the beginning, I was struck by the Riot Girl movement and music that came that was born here in Olympia,
yeah,
and how that changed that, you know, rock and roll is one of the last bastions of this kind of, you know, male dominated world,
yeah,
and the Riot Girls, you know, really turned that upside down. And so Sleater-Kinney, for instance, you know, they've gone on to great success, and Carrie Brownstein's a Washington native, grew up in Redmond, and I just thought it was going to be, I was interested in that all along, and I just thought it'd be too daunting with them on gearing up for this big tour and recording a new album, and she's an author and she's on Portlandia, and I just thought, like, man, I just don't think
you're gonna be
it's
able to
gonna
get
be
that.
Worth it.
Yeah.
So yeah, it happens along the way.
I imagine when you let go of those, you're almost crestfallen, like, oh, I really wanted to head in that direction. Right.
Yeah, but there's so many, there's somebody else right there who's, you know, demanding your time, who's ultra worthy as well. And some of the, you know, back to what John was saying, some of it is shaped by this pairing we did. So,
yeah, which is really cool. I think that's one of the neatest parts of the whole.
Yeah, and sometimes it worked both ways, i.e. meaning, you know, so if we knew Janet McLeod was this, you know, this way ahead of the curve Indian woman on fishing rights, then, you know, that helped us discover or lead us to someone like Fawn Sharp, the president of the Quinault Nation, who's, you know, really, they're fighting like a life and death battle with climate change, it seems. Yeah. So sometimes that pairing did it, you know, with John, with Josephine Corliss Preston.
Yeah.
We thought, like, wow, if we could have an education contemporary match, who might that be? Well,
right.
Annemarie Cousse at the University of Washington came to mind, because she, you know, the university is rated as one of the 10 best in the world that's headed by a woman president.
Yeah.
So that puts her in kind of, you know, rarefied air as well.
Yeah. Okay, cool. And so basically the general sort of theme that's going to be running through this is there's essentially a piece of Washington history, like suffrage or even the justices, where you have the person who paved the way, and then it sounds like almost like the person who benefited from that original person, but then also has taken it to another level.
Whenever we could, we did that. And the perfect analogy is Fawn Sharp and Janet McLeod. We have a picture of them together. I mean, it's pretty remarkable.
Cool.
I mean, here's this young woman, a dynamic young woman, heading the Quinault Nation, former vice president of the National Congress of American Indians, and when Janet McLeod was on the banks of the Nisqually with the likes of Marlon Brando and Billy Frank Jr., I mean, Fawn even said that when she was growing up, some little girls had Barbie dolls, but Billy Frank was her hero.
That's super cool.
They clubbed him, jailed him, they tear gassed him, they put him in jail, and he just kept on going.
Yeah, that's awesome.
That spiritual sense that you get from talking to a person like Fawn, who's just imbued with millennia of Native lore, is really uplifting.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and I think that's what's kind of cool about it too, is if you have a chance to interview the person from the sort of modern era, if you will, you get this really cool sense of, like, the sacrifice ran through all the way to the original person, which is really neat.
Yeah. And then, I mean, the evolution in that case, I mean, from Janet fighting for fishing rights to where we are with Fawn, what is it, only 50 years later? Where, you know, their salmon have disappeared.
Yeah.
I mean, there aren't fish.
Right.
Some of their communities are going to be underwater soon. Yeah. So they're having to move a village.
Yeah.
There was a piece on NPR this morning. In Alaska, warming and ocean acidification has endangered a run of chum salmon in northern Alaska.
Yeah. Yeah, that will vastly affect what happens down here.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah. So talk a little bit about the grand opening of the exhibit, the book. When are they coming out? And are you guys doing – oh, you looked at our producer over here, producer Amber – can you talk a little bit about...
She's slinking in a corner.
She is. She's looking to try and get out now. so can you talk a little bit about the exhibit, when people should expect to see it, the book, how are you guys going to be promoting it?
The exhibit is released officially September 19th here in the Washington State Capitol. Join us at 3 p.m. for a celebration.
There you go.
Open
to the public, yeah. Mm-hmm. We'll have a few of our subjects there speaking. We're still tying that down.
Okay.
And the book will be released? And the book
will be released afterwards. Okay. We're still working on the finishing touches of that. the real big push is to get the panels on the wall.
Yeah.
But all these stories will be available online coming in September.
With the book for holiday giving.
Exactly.
Oh, there you go. It's a perfect gift for the holidays. Yes. You got to say it with a little bit more of a radio voice. A perfect gift for the holidays.
And for teachers out there, there is an accompanying lesson plan that will be available online. All of our projects offer that. So it's very timely for this 2020 centennial of women's voting.
Yeah.
Next year in August, there'll be the big celebration with all of state agencies.
There's something we should emphasize. Happily, we really are ahead of the curve because
you are ahead of the curve.
2020 centennial, our exhibit will still be on the wall in 2020.
That's right.
We got a wonderful help from Frank Blethyn in the Seattle Times over the weekend in publicizing several of these stories in the Seattle Times magazine. But it's going to be a year-long celebration of these amazing dates in the history of feminism.
Yeah.
And the Washington State Historical Society is really leading the way on, they have a women's
history consortium.
And suffrage. There's a whole website dedicated to it.
Yeah. And once these exhibits come down, because 1968 just came down, you don't just hide them in a vault somewhere. You actually work with the Karshner Museum, correct?
Correct. Yeah. In Puyallup, one of the few public school districts that has their own museum.
That's cool.
So all of our exhibits go straight to Karshner, and then they travel the state to all different organizations, history, libraries. And they're available to travel for free with just the cost of getting it there.
Very cool.
Yeah.
All of these stories, by the way, while Lori is working hard on formatting the book, the printed book, all of these stories will be available online.
Yes.
By this fall.
Excellent.
Unedited, full length, and available for free.
That's cool.
And why don't you tell us what the Secretary of State's website is?
Oh, that would be www.sos.wa.gov/legacy?
Yeah.
That's correct.
Wow. Look at that. I know, Phil, you're amazing.
Oh, thank you, guys. Well, hey, I want to thank you guys for coming on the special edition of the podcast. For real, listening to you guys is the reason why I really love history. It's very cool. So thank you, Bob. Thank you, Lori. Thank you, John, for coming on and talking about it.
Thank you, Phil. Fabulous. Thank you.